Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Conservative Christianity is on the rise in America. In politics, in education, even popular entertainment is getting on the Jesus train. But reaching millions and influencing a few politicians, even helping elect a president, is not enough for some believers. To them, the goal is dominion. Tonight on Point, author and former New York Times correspondent Chris Hedges, on his trip to the annual convention of national religious broadcasters and the fired-up drive for conservative Christian dominion over politics and American life. But first, we begin tonight in Washington, where the House of Representatives today took up legislation to add further restrictions on teen abortion. In most states, girls under age 18 already face parental involvement laws. The House bill would add new constraints. Similar legislation has passed the House three times before. The one time it reached the Senate floor, it was filibustered. This time, the outcome could be different. Linda Feldman is White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and is following the latest developments. She joins us now from Washington. Linda, thanks for being with us tonight.
Hi, my pleasure.
So what's in this legislation package?
This legislation, the first piece of it is something that the House, as you said, has already passed several times before. It is a provision that would make it a federal offense to transport a minor girl across state lines so she can have an abortion if this is done to evade a parental notification rule. But there's also a new requirement in this law, which makes it more stringent than the last time the House passed this, which is a requirement that an abortion provider in a state, in a different state from the girl's residence, must notify a parent in advance before he can perform the abortion.
So restraints on both sides of the state line in this case.
That's right, and you could wind up with situations where a girl who doesn't feel she can get her parents' permission has to get a judicial waiver from two states. Let's say a girl lives in northern Mississippi, and it's much more convenient for her to go into Tennessee. Both states have parental involvement laws, so she'd have to fulfill the requirements of both states.
How common is it for young American females under 18 to cross state lines for abortions these days? How significant an issue is this?
This is a very significant issue because underage girls are, in many ways, among the least advantaged females that face tough abortions. They're young, they're confused, they're scared. Sometimes they wait longer than they should to make a decision about what to do, and sometimes this even pushes them into the second trimester, which brings up more state laws and more restrictions.
Now, this has passed three times before, or something similar, as you say, a new wrinkle this time. It's never passed the Senate. Could it pass the Senate this time? Could it become law?
It absolutely could become law. In the last election, the thinking is that about three more pro-life senators, there's a net gain of three pro-life senators in the U.S. Senate now, and I think supporters of this legislation are optimistic.
Which senators are getting the most attention? Who might be the swing votes in the U.S. Senate?
Gosh, I don't know. I haven't thought about that, unfortunately. We're really focused right now on the House, where it should pass easily. They're voting right now, actually.
And President Bush, as he said, whether or not he would sign, I assume he would.
Yes, he will. He has said he will sign it.
How soon could this be the law of the land, Linda?
It could happen quite soon, actually, within a matter of weeks.
And the defenders of abortion, what are they saying about its potential impact?
Well, they're saying that it could have a great impact. There are not good statistics on how often underage females cross state lines to get abortions. But I was speaking with a woman who owns six clinics in six different states, and she said that in at least one of her clinics every day, they're getting a judicial bypass. That is, somebody who is can't talk to her parents about what's happening with her and has to go to a judge. And she says she's seeing girls coming in from other states all the time. So this is an example of anti-abortion legislation that will have an actual impact, in contrast with the ban on so-called partial birth abortion, which has gotten a lot of attention in recent years, but in fact is not is not in effect. It's been enjoined in the courts, and in fact has already been found unconstitutional. So it's now on appeal and still caught in the legal process.
But this is real-world anti-abortion lobby. The anti-abortion lobby on the Hill must be riding high.
Well, they are riding high, and they're also, this is a sort of an interesting tactic on their part, because right now, of course, we're focused very heavily on the future of judicial nominations. The religious conservatives very much want to keep adding anti-abortion judges to the judiciary, including the Supreme Court, and so there's a lot of focus right now on how judges are confirmed, and this one is sort of came up out of nowhere. I mean, people have been following this, knew this was coming, but it hasn't gotten a lot of attention in the press because everyone's focus so closely on the so-called nuclear option.
Well, it's front and center right now. Linda, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Linda Feldman, White House correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. Former New York Times correspondent Chris Hedges has covered armies on the march around the world. Recently, the sound of a different advance caught his ear, the sound of Christian soldiers. He followed them to Southern California and the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, where, he says, the fiery theme was not just support for judicial nominees or creationist school curricula, but for a new dominion of conservative Christianity over American life. Evangelical leaders railed against a culture they describe as hijacked by secularists, awash in sin, and ripe for a return to biblical law. And, says Hedges, they feel it happening. This hour on Point, the call for conservative Christian dominion over the country and the tradition of pluralism. You can join the conversation. Are you on board with the surging conservative Christian drive to real-world power? Or are you running the other way? And can the evangelical drive to power and real pluralism coexist in this country or not? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Chris Hedges, former New York Times reporter, author of War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. His latest piece for the May issue of Harper's Magazine is headlined Feeling the Hate with the National Religious Broadcasters. Good evening and welcome, Chris Hedges.
Thank you.
Chris, thanks for being with us. What took you to Anaheim, California, and the National Convention of Religious Broadcasters?
It's the most powerful media organization or media umbrella organization within the Christian right, and brings together most of the major radio and television broadcasters throughout the country. These people reach tens of millions of Americans. They've set up a parallel information network, perhaps indoctrination would not be too strong a word, which presents their view of the world and their view of reality exclusively to believers. And, of course, part of that is a heavy attack against the mainstream media and organizations that they believe are in the grip of secular humanists.
And I want to get a sense of who's at this. Is this really just a kind of broadcasters separate from men and women of the cloth, or is this preachers? Are these actual evangelical leaders of the evangelical movement?
No, very much includes evangelical leaders because, of course, they use radio and television outlets to disseminate their message and to reach many of their followers. This is a very media-savvy organization. So most of the main speakers at the event are, in fact, well-known Christian right or radical Christian right figures, such as James Dobson.
Head of Focus on the Family.
Exactly. Or Tony Perkins, who we just saw on Justice Sunday, the head of the Family Research Council, which was started and largely funded by Mr. Dobson's Focus on the Family.
And what's the tone? I was struck by the several kind of themes in tone, but paint a picture for us of the atmosphere. What's the tone, Chris, that you found?
Well, completely intolerant of any other way of being or any other way of thinking. A sense of victimization that was hammered home. And again, for those people who looked at Justice Sunday, that was a very heavy theme there. The cult of masculinity. This is a very patriarchal movement. It's a movement which sees Christ as an avenging figure, constant quotations from Revelations as well as from those passages in the Gospels where Christ goes in and upsets the temple, the tables at the temple of the money changers. It is a movement that not only attempts to delegitimize those that disagree with it, and one has to remember that part of this assault is against people they refer to as nominal Christians. These are, in their eyes, Christians who are not Bible-believing Christians, but they demonize the movement. And the words they use, I think, are quite frightening, especially for someone like myself who came out of the war in Yugoslavia and saw what that kind of hate talk did to whip up tensions between Croats, Muslims, and Serbs.
Chris, you describe a sense of victimization, and yet as I read your reporting here, there's also a sense of real muscle here, of flexing real power, new power, and an appetite for more.
Well, they certainly have real power. They have made tremendous inroads into the executive and the legislative branch, and as we are seeing now, there is an assault by this force against the American judiciary. They have received hundreds of millions of dollars in federal money to set up parallel social service organizations as well as parallel educational systems where those people who are employed by them, and in many cases those people who they assist, have to conform to an ideological litmus test.
And there's a lot more dominion they have in mind, as you describe it, even dominionism as a movement. Of course, millions of Americans welcome this, Chris Hedges. They see it as an antidote to all kinds of social ills.
You know, I suspect that many people within the movement, and, you know, I come from a small town, rural, impoverished town in Maine, where even members of my own family would be considered, if you took a census, part of the Christian right. My grandmother gave money to Oral Roberts, are not aware of the vision, the ultimate vision that this movement has.
Chris Hedges, please stand by. We'll come back and hear a lot more. We're talking tonight with former New York Times reporter Chris Hedges about his visit to the annual convention of the National Religious Broadcasters Association and the drive for conservative Christian dominion in American politics and American life. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former New York Times reporter Chris Hedges about his visit to the annual convention of the National Religious Broadcasters Association and the drive, very much in evidence there, for conservative Christian dominion in American politics and American life. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you ready for the Christian movement that sees America as hijacked by secularists and ready to be taken back by religion? Are you tuned in to the thriving conservative vision of a re-Christianized America, of conservative Christian dominion in politics and culture? Are you on board or are you running the other way? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Chris Hedges writes about it in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. Chris, I wish you'd flesh out the picture of this movement you describe is called as dominionism. Not everybody who's on board likes that name, but what is it?
Well, dominionism comes out of a theological movement that began within the far Christian right in the early 70s. Probably the person who we can call the godfather of the movement is a man named Roussas Rashtuni, who wrote a book called The Institutes of Biblical Law. At the time, he called it Christian Reconstructionism. But in essence, what it is a belief that believers can create the Christian society, and that once the Christian society is created, Christ will return. This is very different from past religious revival movements. We've had many in the country in two important ways. In all of these revival movements up until now, those caught up in the revival have been urged to turn away from the contamination of secular culture.
Sure.
This, of course, movement is calling on followers to take control of that culture, to seize political power. And the other important difference is that up until now, most evangelicals have been post-millennialists. They have believed that when Christ returns, the rapture comes, Armageddon, the Christian society will then be instituted from above. These people are premillennialists. They believe that, in fact, they will create the Christian society in order to facilitate Christ's return. And this is a very important Teutonic shift. Tectonic shift that I think has been missed by many outside the movement. These are not, this is not Billy Graham. This is a very, very different kind of movement. And in fact, Graham and the followers of Graham, like Louis Palau and other more traditional evangelicals who've been more concerned with personal salvation and conversion, have been shunted aside. We've seen this in religious institutions such as the Southern Baptist Convention. The Dominionists have taken over that movement, and it was quite a concerted effort spelled out in the early 80s by Pat Robertson and others. And those traditional evangelicals, one thinks of Jimmy Carter, for instance, who was pushed out of his own church when it was essentially seized by Dominionists, have been deeply marginalized. So I think it's important to understand that this is not the movement that, for instance, I grew up with. I grew up in the church. My father was a Presbyterian minister, and I think, as you mentioned, I also went to Harvard Divinity School.
Yes, and you describe this kind of diverse group, a curious hybrid is how you put it, fundamentalists, Pentecostalists, Southern Baptists, conservative Catholics, charismatics, other evangelicals, who, in your words, share a belief that America is destined to become a Christian nation led by Christian men who are in turn directed by God. You quote one of the broadcasters there, radio host James McDonald, saying, quoting theologian Peter Berger, saying the ages of faith are not marked by dialogue, but by proclamation. And they're very real-world agenda items that were on the table there, as you describe it. Broadcasters very much against hate crime legislation because it might restrict them from talking about gays and lesbians on air in the way that they're accustomed to. Also very opposed to enforcement of the fairness doctrine in broadcasting. You quote one saying, if we had to give equal time to every opposing viewpoint, there would be no time to proclaim the truth that we've been commanded to proclaim. George Bush is in the White House and evangelicals helped put him there, but a sense that they're by no means finished with their agenda.
Not at all, and in some ways they're frustrated with George Bush because he has yet to really implement any of their core concerns. We will see over the next few years in the Bush administration what he does with any vacancies on the Supreme Court. But this has been a long frustration since the arrival of Jimmy Carter, certainly within Ronald Reagan. Many people in the radical Christian right movement had high hopes for the Reagan administration, but the hot button issues that they use to essentially fire up the faithful. One thinks of the assaults against gays and lesbians with these referendums that ran in 11 states to ban gay marriage. Of course, 10 of those states, gay marriage was already illegal. The Bush administration has yet to deliver, and they are a powerful and well-funded grassroots movement, and they expect to see their agenda to begin to be implemented as the law of the land. And this is essentially what James Dobson, who I think in many ways is probably the most powerful movement the most powerful figure in the movement,
out of Colorado Springs,
out of Colorado Springs, told Bush after he was reelected.
Well, they've said as much. Look, we got you there, and now we have certain expectations, and we want to see them fulfilled. I'm struck again at the fact that there are many Americans, as you say, not all Americans may understand exactly what's afoot here, but many do and are supportive. You're clearly critical, Chris. How do you see this movement coexisting with the American tradition of pluralism? Does it coexist with pluralism? Can it? Will it?
Well, it certainly does not embrace pluralism. That's why I find it so frightening. It is a movement that does not believe that there is another way of being, another way of thinking, other valid viewpoints. It is a movement that does not believe in compromise. It is a movement that has nothing but open disdain for our open society. They're quite frank about it, and I urge all of your listeners to take some time and listen to the Christian or the hard-right Christian radio and television broadcasts and to see the kind of language they use and the kinds of things they're saying. It's very chilling for those of us who come out of a traditional democratic society where we believe in the free exchange of ideas and the validity of various viewpoints within a democratic system.
I want to hear a voice straight from that movement, if we may. Joining us now from Raleigh, North Carolina, is Reverend Christopher Ortiz. He's pastor and communications director of the Chalcedon Foundation. It's a Christian Reconstruction educational organization. Reverend Ortiz, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Well, you bet, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. We want to understand dominionism. It's kind of part of the charter of your organization, as I understand it, named after the Council of Chalcedon, A.D. 451, where in your website it says the unity of Christ's divine and human natures was defined and his lordship proclaimed as opposed to the claims of the state to be God on earth. Jesus Christ is the one. In your vision of Christian dominion, what's the role of the Church of Christianity in American politics and American culture?
Well, and this is probably where me and Mr. Hedges would be on complete different sides of the street. I'm a little puzzled by a lot of what he said because a lot of the information is incorrect.
In what sense?
Well, as far as the Chalcedon Foundation, which I represent, is the organization started by Roussos John Rushdoony, the gentleman that he mentioned,
yes.
And that he's very correct. That's really where it started.
Mm-hmm.
And that organization started in 1965, and it was in the first issue of his newsletter that he used the term Christian Reconstruction. Institutes of Biblical Law, written in 72, did not come around for 7 years.
And do you seek Christian dominion in American politics, culture, life?
We do not seize political power, in fact.
Seek, not seize, but seek.
Website, mm-hmm. We talk about that a lot. In fact, Christian Reconstruction is quite the opposite. We want to minimize state. I think where a lot of people on the left make their mistake, and I don't want to imply that Mr. Hedges is on the left. I don't know what his political orientation is. But for those, our typical opponents who hail from the left, for them, salvation is by politics and state coercion. Everything, you know, public education, health, welfare, speech codes, everything is state finance. Man is essentially a plastic being that is reshaped by external means. And that's the fundamentalism of socialism. But what they tend to do is think that we're operating the same way. Now, I can understand it.
So how are you operating? What's your goal?
Well, our call is to build Christian civilization by a decentralized social order. So our greater concern is going to be with Christians themselves.
And what's your view of pluralism and secular humanism, let's say?
Well, I mean, obviously, if the Judeo-Christian God exists and the Bible is his word, then it only makes sense that we would work in terms of that.
In terms of what?
In terms of that revealed will.
Does that leave room for pluralism? Does that leave room for secular humanism or not?
No, of course not. There is nothing secular if he's created everything.
So whether or not you operate through the government, I mean, we do have a strong American tradition of pluralism. Does your movement see that as the future or something to be shunted aside?
No. I mean, I think for us in the long term, here's another one of the mistakes that Mr. Hedges made. He referred to the dominionists as premillennialists. It would be the opposite. Genuine dominionists from Christian Reconstruction have always been postmillennial. Again, I think a lot of the confusion comes in is because of the outspoken pundits such as Dobson and Falwell and others, which we do not identify with. We would not consider them dominionists. We would consider them activists.
But you would like to see the tradition of pluralism set aside, certainly secular humanism set aside, in favor of a kind of godly Christian dominion in American life.
We would be all in favor of godly Christian culture. I mean, you still have, I mean, the majority of American culture is Christian culture. You know what I mean? It outlaws theft. It outlaws murder. These are all things.
In any case, easily tied back to the Ten Commandments. Okay.
Right, but here again, as post-millennialists, you know, we would not see a godly social order coming about for quite some time, long after you and I are gone. Where I think the threat comes in for gentlemen like Mr. Hedges and others is because others have hijacked our parlance, if you will, and they're using it, and you know they're out on the Fox News networks and the cable news shows and pounding their fists and you know wanting to get this judge in or stop this and stop that. That's not us. We are working for a long-term cause. Yes, it's Christian civilization, but we are doing that through the institutions of the family, Christian education. It's a decentralized social order. We do not believe in political dominion.
Reverend Ortiz, please stand by. Christopher Hedges, here's an interesting picture emerging. Even Christopher Ortiz, whose group comes from the Rastuni that you cited, saying that he feels like his sense of Christian dominion movement has been hijacked by people pushing for a quicker, more state-oriented implementation.
Well, I think that one has to realize that this is, you know, this movement is comprised of a collection of groups that still have very deep doctrinal differences. I mean, when I was at this convention, you know, there were Catholics, there were members of the Salvation Army. What unites them is this effort to create what they would call a Christian nation and base the legal system on their interpretation of the Bible. This was very much part of Rashtuni's Institutes of Biblical Law, to create a legal system based on the Ten Commandments, where the death penalty would be imposed for a series of moral crimes. I can't remember exactly, but I believe Rashtuni lists either 18 or 23, or I'm sure Mr. Ortiz knows precisely. And when they talk about the withering way of the federal state, this is very much part of their agenda. But I think we have to ask, what is it that they will replace it with? What they intend to replace it with, of course, is an authoritarian church, a church that has control over the educational system as well as social services, and leaving the state, at least from my reading of Rashtuni, to essentially handle property rights and national defense and nothing else.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Chris Hedges, Reverend Ortiz says this is not something that's just around the corner. It's in the distant future. Is that the sense of the convention that you attended? This is far off.
No, and I think that at least from many of the leaders of the movement, you know, listen to the words, for instance, of Pat Robertson, there is a belief that it's getting closer and closer. I mean, one of the interesting little sort of tidbits of information is that when President Bush was first elected, Pat Robertson resigned as head of the Christian Coalition. And the speculation is that that's because President Bush was the first of the series of regents. And remember that Pat Robertson runs Regent University, which is designed to create the Christian cadre who will govern America. It has a law school. It has a journalism school. And there's a feeling that, especially when you look at things like the Rapture Index, it measures how close the rapture is. And
to heaven of devout Christians, yes?
Yes, there is a sense that, you know, this apocalyptic end times is looming closer and closer. You know, many followers talk about the war in Iraq as being predicted in the book of Revelation. So I don't know that anyone said a year, I think there's certainly a feeling in the movement that they are gaining in power and that they are moving towards the kind of conclusion they seek.
Reverend Ortiz, we've only got a couple more minutes with you. I want to ask, in the view of the ideal society that your group propounds, what's the role for non-Christians or for Christians who don't share your interpretation of the Bible and Christian teaching?
Well, there's freedom under God's law.
What does that mean?
Freedom under God's law. Well, it's much what you have today. I mean, I'm not free to go, you know, going down the highway at 100 miles an hour when the speed limit sign says 55, but I have latitude within that 55 miles an hour. It's not going to be some sort of persecution. All of this, again, is speculative at best. We're only studying the scriptures and seeing what they portray as what a godly social order would look like. But again, we're talking about something that is so far down the road.
But many of your, I'm not sure what word to use since you say some people have hijacked these views. Many people that Chris Hedges saw at the big convention in California were looking at something much more imminent, something happening now.
Absolutely. I would agree with him. And I think much of what he describes is accurate, and it's as frustrating to us as it is to him. It's as dangerous to us. This is why I call them activists and not dominionists. Genuine Christian dominion is something that takes place over time because it's God-oriented. As God's people are faithful to his covenant and his revealed will as they are contained in the scriptures, he will bless them culturally. But that is not something that man seizes by hand. It's not something that he seizes by political coercion. Now, those who are doing it are those who have hijacked the rhetoric. They've hijacked the terms, and they're pushing them to the fore.
I guess they had the microphone in California at this big national convention.
They own the microphone.
we hear you. Reverend Ortiz, Christopher Ortiz, thank you very much for being with us tonight. We're grateful to you.
You bet, man.
Reverend Christopher Ortiz, pastor and communications director of the Chalcedon Foundation, a national Christian Reconstructionist Education Organization. Chris Hedges, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us, 1-800-423-825. In a moment, Harvey Cox will join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with former New York Times reporter Chris Hedges about his visit to the annual convention of the National Religious Broadcasters Association and the drive for conservative Christian dominion in American politics and American life. His article out in the current issue of Harper's is Feeling the Hate with the National Religious Broadcasters. A lot of questions here tonight, and I'm sorry to keep callers waiting, but here's just some more. Does a vision of America recentered on the Ten Commandments, creationism, and politically empowered conservative Christianity sound welcome to you? Does it sound paranoid? Does it sound un-American? And can a conservative Christian drive to power and pluralism coexist in this country? Or does there have to be a winner and a loser? Is the idea of personal salvation, now old hat? Does religion have to have public power, political power to count? And is the American tent big enough for all Americans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined right now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, by Harvey Cox. He's professor at Harvard Divinity School, author of many books, including Religion in the Secular City and the Reshaping of Religion in the 21st Century. Harvey Cox, great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So I don't know if you've been able to read Chris Hedges' report yet, but you've heard a taste of it tonight, and you must be tuned into what's going on here.
I've read it, and I'm tuned in.
Well, and then you hear Reverend Ortiz from Raleigh, North Carolina, saying, look, we came up with this, kind of, and this isn't what we're preaching. What's going on? What do you interpret as going on in this popular drive, conservative Christian drive to political power as a matter of Christian dominion?
Well, what is going on is an awful lot of infighting, and I think you got a little taste of that this evening.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Chris noticed that when he was at this meeting in California. In fact, he talks there about his interview with Luis Palau, who probably the most widely recognized evangelist in the tradition of Billy Graham.
An old friend of Billy Graham, but I have to say, Chris Hedges finds him at the margins of this convention, of this great
of that
gathering.
Convention, but not at the margin of the American evangelical community.
Hmm.
Certainly not. I mean, this is a community which is very much divided over these issues. You may have noticed a couple of weeks ago that the vice president of the National Association of Evangelicals, his name is Wenzel,
mm-hmm.
delivered a blistering attack on the Christian right at Gordon Conwell Seminary, right up here north of Boston. And there are movements within the evangelical community that are very critical of the Christian right. And what the Dominionists represent is a relatively small group. They are feeling pretty empowered now, but they, as Chris rightly says, they're really disgusted with Bush because he's not doing what they think he should do, especially with reference to Israel.
With reference to Israel, meaning?
Yeah. But in a lot of other respects as well.
Sure, right. Not least judges. They're not happy yet,
No.
And right on down the line. But as our Reverend Ortiz said, from his vantage in North Carolina, looking out toward this convention, they've got the microphone. There may be infighting, Harvey Cox, but do the kind of more strident, let's take real world power folks have the big mo here? Do they have the momentum?
They may have momentum, and they certainly had that microphone out there. He was right about that. They don't have all the microphones. And what's going to happen, I think, is the closer they get to real power, the more they're going to fight with each other. These are not people who compromise easily, as Chris said. And political effectiveness in America has to do with making deals, with compromising, with taking half a loaf. So they have a tendency, when they don't get what they want, to sort of fold up the tent and go home, or to splinter into further fragmentation. I think what we're watching in American evangelical and fundamentalist life now is growth and fragmentation, and we're going to see a lot more of it.
Chris Hedges, let me ask you. Harvey Cox suggests that this is ultimately a self-limiting movement, that there's infighting, there are different factions, that it's not all going to go their way, and they'll eventually kind of fracture and go home. Do you see that?
Well, Harvey's certainly right that there are deep schisms within the movement as well as deep animosities. And I think even with the interview with Reverend Ortiz tonight, caught a taste of that. I think what worries me is that the movement, for many of the reasons Harvey cited, as well as, I think, a kind of backlash that would happen if they actually started to implement some of their agenda, turn some of their agenda into law,
I'm sorry, Chris, but you could say that some of their agenda is being turned into law now.
Yes, slowly, piecemeal.
Okay.
It has a
but
kind
not
of
on
evolutionary.
The scale that,
well, I mean, abortion isn't murder, right. For instance.
Yeah,
I mean,
under
that's certainly
law
what they're
now.
Working towards.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think what worries me is that if our democracy suffers a crisis, a genuine crisis, whether that's an economic crisis, whether that's another act of catastrophic domestic terrorism, we may very well find that the Dominionists, and who have built a very powerful alliance with the neocons, remember,
mm-hmm.
May be ruthless enough to stifle dissent within their own movement and use the crisis.
But only in the context of another major crisis? Otherwise, you're saying we're going to stick with what we've known, more or less?
I think that as long as we live in a period of relative stability, this very hard, radical movement will have a hard time achieving power. Let me also add that having spent a year of my life covering al-Qaeda for the New York Times, there was not an intelligence chief who I interviewed who didn't feel that another act of domestic catastrophic terrorism was not inevitable. And I think that if we remember the mood after 9/11, imagine that mood coming back. They used 9/11 to push through the Patriot Act. They used 9/11 to justify the war in Iraq. And I think another act of that magnitude would begin to see a real distortion of our open society.
And yet, even without that, you can't help but see a lot of influence out of this corner. Justice Sunday, just the other day, you quote one of the attendees talking about the 130 members of the House of Representatives who are now born again. There are Americans behind this, and it's clearly got clout right now.
Can I come in on that born again phrase?
Yes, sir, Harvey Cox.
Remember that there are many, many millions of people in the United States who consider themselves one way or another born again. Episcopalians believe they're born again when they're baptized, remember, and they say that. Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton was a Southern Baptist. I think we have to be very careful not to throw out a whole wide group of people because of a small group, a relatively small group that we're talking about here tonight, who are part of the evangelical spectrum, but are in it with a lot of other people. And I also think we have to be very careful in opposing, as I do, as much as Chris does, I do, the Dominion vision of America. I'm against it. We have to do it without suggesting that those people who have something to offer to the political and social climate of America from a religious point of view shouldn't be shut up.
Amen.
There's Martin Luther King, after all, who spoke from a biblical perspective.
Amen. Harvey Cox, I guess I only cite it because it was cited by those at the podium at the convention. The 130 House members are cited as our team, not by, I'm not saying so, But it's used by those with a kind of dominionist agenda to say...
They would like us to think that they have an awful lot of power, an awful lot of troops, because that's part of their strategy.
We've got so many callers, I want to turn to them. They've been so patiently waiting. Reza is calling from Alston, Massachusetts. Reza, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you today?
Well, thanks.
I have a quick comment to make. I come from a fundamentalist country. I escaped Iran to escape the fundamentalist, the religious people. And this is very scary for me now, listening to the radio. And somehow I hear the reassuring words of Harvey, and then goes back. It's like a roller coaster to go back to Chris with his convincing words. I just want to know, is this a really serious threat, or is this just a minor, as you put it, paranoia?
Reza, that is a reasonable question, and I can feel us all still wrestling with it here. Thank you for your call. Chris, I just let me put that to you. At the close of your article, you get pretty fiery yourself. You quote an old professor of yours at Harvard Divinity School, Dr. James Luther Adams, and it's tough language here. He was close to 80 when he was teaching you and told your class that within your lifetime, you would all be fighting what he called Christian fascists. Now, are we talking some distant, unlikely thing? Is this inappropriate language? Should Reza be really worried, or is this going to all work out fine? We're still in the American mainstream here.
Well, I certainly think we should be worried about it. You know, I've learned a long time ago as a reporter that it's a pretty dangerous business to start predicting the future. In terms of James Luther Adams, this was a man, by the way, who was in Germany in the 1930s. He certainly saw those fascist yearnings within this political religion at that time, expressed primarily by people like Pat Robertson. You know, this final aesthetic of violence, this cult of masculinity, this intolerance. And I think also, you know, I covered Iran, and Reza, I think, knows even better than I do that despite the heavy doctrinal differences within the clerics in Iran, despite the kind of infighting, they were united in this vision of creating an Islamic nation. And that didn't stop the bloodletting between them. But as long as they had that common goal, they worked in tandem. And I think that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing people with deep, deep animosities and divisions unite around this theme. You know, the doctrinal differences between Catholics and Southern Baptists when I was a boy growing up in the church were unbridgeable. Now you're seeing them work together.
Harvey Cox, a simple, honest question from Reza, who's allergic here because he's been through it in Iran, and he asks, look, help me understand if this is really a serious problem or things going to be okay here. What's your sense, Harvey?
I think we should be concerned about it but not panicked. I'll put it that way. I think Chris's article is a useful and informative article, and there are a lot of people within and outside the evangelical community who are against this movement, who are going to speak and write as well, and we should be encouraging them. But I wouldn't buy a ticket out of the country quite yet.
I guess not. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Josh is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Josh. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you. What's on your mind, Josh?
Well, I am a Christian. I, you know, follow the Bible and have made Jesus the Lord of my life. And the thing that I don't understand about these people who would turn America into a sort of theocratic state is that Jesus plainly said, my kingdom isn't of this world. And I guess I'm wondering what your guests think about that. You know, he plainly said that Israel would be recreated in another time and not in this time. And I don't understand how that message has been lost on these, you know, these activists that the other man mentioned.
Yeah, Chris, it's a good question. Chris Hedges?
It's a great question. And, you know, it's an important point because Jesus repeatedly rejects the mantle of secular power. But the dominionists pick very narrow passages that I think deeply distort the biblical message. I don't know how you can read the four Gospels and not walk away with the understanding that Jesus was a pacifist. I'm not a pacifist myself. But, you know, that many of those messages, along with all the calls in the Gospels by Christ to take care of the marginalized, the poor, the dispossessed, the weak, the outcasts, are ignored in essence. And of course, they quote heavily from the Book of Revelation, as well as some of the more apocalyptic passages in Paul. And I think that, and we can get Harvey to comment on this, but I think I feel these people have deeply distorted what the Bible is about.
Harvey, I agree with Chris on that. And if you listen carefully to the way they talk and the way they preach, they don't talk about Jesus very much. Very rarely. You hear them talking about the Ten Commandments, about the Levitical law, but very rarely they just stay away from Jesus because he doesn't strengthen their case. They pull out a couple things from the Book of Revelation, but I think your caller from North Carolina is right. I mean, these are people who really aren't on the same wavelength as Jesus at all.
Let's get another call. John is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems to me that these radical fundamentalist dominionists, in order to achieve their goals, would basically have to abolish parts of the Constitution, specifically the First Amendment. So in a nutshell, what they're calling for is the overthrow of the United States government as we know it.
Simply put, and let us pick it up. Chris Hedges, what about it? What about the Constitution and the U.S. government as we know it, as John says?
Yes, they certainly have a very different vision from that proposed by the Constitution and the Founding Fathers, who reacted strongly against the kind of theocratic states that were set up by the Puritans to ensure religious pluralism and religious freedom for all. So yes, I think that they really want to reform the government in a way that would, in many ways, violate the core beliefs that were set out when we were founded.
Harvey Cox, we just got a couple of minutes here. You've pointed out the many faces of Christianity. You say this is just one, and yet because Chris was at an association of broadcasters, they have big microphones, a lot of sway, and what appears to be a lot of clout in Washington today. Where do you see the overall political impact of Christianity heading in the United States today? Are these folks driving the train, whatever people in the rear cars may think?
I think they'd like to drive the train, but I don't think they are. And we've already listed a lot of their agenda, which is being either ignored or subverted. Mm-hmm. They may get a couple things through. I think they're going to overreach, badly overreach, the closer they get to power. I think they're going to be fighting each other. So I don't tend to be quite as worried about it as some people are, but I do take them seriously. I think they have some, especially their enormous skill with the media, which you know something about, Tom. Mm. These people really know how to run the media. When I visited Pat Robertson's university, they had the most advanced media lab down there to train their students anywhere I've ever seen, much better than we have at Harvard. Mm. They know the power of communication, and they're working hard at it. But they still represent way less than a majority, and certainly not represent Christianity in America at all.
Chris Hedges, we've just got half a minute here, but what feeling did you go away with from the convention?
I would certainly agree with Harvey that they, I think 2/3 or plus of this country, including many of their followers, do not want to live in the vision of the United States that they have. Nevertheless, I think we have to remember that radical movements have always been a minority, and it's the kind of tactics they're willing to employ and the passivity and complacency on the part of the majority that has made radicalism possible.
Chris Hedges, the article in Harper's, this month's issue. Thanks very much for being with us tonight, Chris.
Thank you.
And Harvey Cox, professor at Harvard Divinity School. Harvey Cox, thank you very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.